Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 5, titled Chicanery.
Chicanery.
Oh, man, there's so much chicanery in this episode.
It sounds like a New Zealand pronunciation for Sean Connery.
Yeah.
It's chicanery.
That was his surname in Zardoz, actually. Nobody knows that. Zardoz Chicanery.
Yeah.
What do you think of this episode?
So if you don't know, at the end of each week, Jim and I do this Bald Move Television podcast, and we do this kind of playful feature called Who Won the Week, where we decide amongst the three big shows we're covering right now, Fargo, The Leftovers, and Better Call Saul, who won the week. And boy, Fargo and Better Call Saul just keep chipping away at Leftovers, and it keeps on slapping all comers.
Uh-huh.
My immediate reaction on finishing this episode is, oh my God, I think Better Call Saul won the week.
You do?
I do have some reservations and second thoughts that we can talk about later, but my initial visceral reaction, keeping in mind I have the biggest hate boner for Chuck that probably anyone has,
yeah.
This was an amazing piece of filmmaking. What did you think?
Yeah, I also really, really enjoyed it. I can't even stress how excellent the performance from Michael McKean is here. Like, top to bottom. I mean, his sanctimonious speeches about the law to himself in the windows, all the way down to, you know, the moment where he's caught out.
They really paint him as a sociopath.
They do, yeah.
Like, I mean, I know it's standard practice to kind of rehearse your legal speeches and...
Sure.
But it's not a good look to catch someone, you know, delivering something, oh no, that's too cold.
Yeah.
And then...
Because he's all of those things, right?
Yeah.
As he's saying them, yep, you're cold, you're sanctimonious.
Like, yes.
You are all of these things, Chuck. That's just you.
Yeah, yeah. You can put the lipstick on the pig and see where it gets you. And then by the end of the show, I almost say movie because it's so cinematic. At the end of the show when, you know, they just relentlessly pull in on this close-up of him, mm-hmm. and then... He looks over to the people of the bar, the panel of the lawyers in the bar, and he can see just how kind of horrified they are, and then everyone in the room, and he realizes what's happened, and then he just tries to shove it back down,
yeah.
and it just makes him look more of a sociopath.
It does, yeah.
So, fuck Chuck, vindication, although I'm not sure, like, I don't, like, this was definitely courtroom theatrics, but I don't know... How much trouble Jimmy's still in?
So that's the thing. I think, you know, Jimmy is not going to get disbarred likely, but
right.
he will probably be suspended. And I wonder what an unemployed Jimmy looks like. It probably looks like Slippin' Jimmy.
I don't know because I – so even though I – you know, obviously I praised this episode to high heavens. However, the courtroom proceedings itself felt, to borrow a word from Kim's friend, a little baroque.
Okay.
And that I felt, I don't know, it just seems to me obvious if I'm, I keep thinking about what that the New York lawyer wrote in last week where he's like, man, I would not touch this case. This seems like this is family fuckery at its finest. And even before Chuck had a complete meltdown and Jimmy proved that his condition is all psychosomatic and that he might be crazy, like, it just that's a plain reading of the facts of the case.
Mm-hmm.
This brother deliberately engineered something to provoke his brother into a reaction he knew he would have, and he had all these people to witness it. And yeah, I guess it's a crime, but...
It's a crime to kick down his door and take a fire poker to his desk and destroy his property.
Yeah,
sure.
But it's kind of like whenever I see a celebrity snap on a paparazzi who's been hounding them for... And I'm like, is that a crime?
Right.
Like, I mean, I don't want to go back to the bad old days, but there used to be a concept called, like, fighting words that, like... You provoke someone where the law used to recognize that we're kind of animals in a certain way, and that there's the party that provokes someone into an outrageous response
mm-hmm.
has a little bit, and I know that's uncomfortable where it intersects in different ways, but
yeah.
I don't know, and I'm not a lawyer, and you know my code of justice isn't the law of the land, thank God, but it just felt like a lot of this stuff. Was just built up and built up and built up, and then they brought in Chuck's wife, and then they brought in Huell, which was awesome. But I just wondered, like, man, this is a whole lot for a very little thing. And also, if the real problem is Jimmy committed assault and battery and armed and forced robbery, how does any of this directly deal with that problem.
Yeah.
Oh, you proved Chuck is a crazy asshole? Well, you still assaulted him and broke into his house.
Yeah, so I think where they're going with this is they're... So this trial is not over, right? This hearing is still in progress as we leave it at the end of this episode.
Right.
I think they're gonna start leaning on, like, here's why I did this, and the thing that I said on the tape is actually a lie, just like Chuck was lying about his condition, right? I mean, he's trying to establish a pattern of Chuck playing up this condition in order to affect an outcome for himself.
That gets him out of destruction of evidence, and maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's the thing that really is bugging the bar. And they did a couple of things to suggest that. Where the guy's like, "Look, this tape is important because," but I don't know. Do you also think,
because really what's on trial here is his ethics as a lawyer, right? It's not necessarily about, like, a crime that he's committed.
Well, I mean, that's all kind of goes to it. If you committed felonious assault and breaking and entering, then that, you know.
But it's more important the destruction of the evidence. Like, that speaks to his character as his respect for the law, I guess.
Do you know – so here's the other thing that kind of after the pageantry washed over and I watched it again. Last week we talked about how we were a little bit bugged about, you know, Jim and Kimmy – or Jimmy and Kim – their little thing at the end where Kim, you know, makes a big deal out of the tape and Chuck's like, oh, it's going to be this, going to be that. And she's like, ah, bingo.
I still don't get it.
There was nothing around the tape at all. Now, maybe the bingo was we've got him so fixated on the tape that he's not going to and maybe that explains Jimmy's multi-stage rope-a-dope that, like, Chuck was going to be ready for one or two. Mm-hmm. But, like, a complicated con within a con.
Yeah.
That is something that he wouldn't be ready for. But that's what I'm saying. Like, the emotions and the theatrics were just right. The actual mechanics of how this stuff was working out, I'm not too sure about.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't totally played out yet either. So maybe we need to give it another episode before we say, oh, some things don't make sense, or I don't see where they're going with this.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was still a great episode of TV.
The experience of watching it was amazing. And I was just speechless after I got done watching it the first time.
Are you ready for the recap?
Yes, let's do it. I want to let everybody know what's going on at Bald Move this week, because there's a lot. It's packed this spring and early summer. I don't know if you've noticed. Seth and I recorded a podcast on The Handmaid's Tale, the first four episodes of that. The first three or four episodes of Dear White People on Netflix, and also we got a little bit of reaction from the first episode of American Gods. We hadn't seen the second one yet. That's going to be a recurring segment we're doing every other week. That's on a Bald Move TV at baldmove.com. We also last week released a segment called Quit Your Pitching that is an exclusive club piece of content where Jim and I make up titles of episodes of fictional TV shows, and we pitch each other what they'd be about. And we're actually putting a snippet of that on the tail end of this podcast if you'd like to enjoy that. Which one did you select? Hardcastle and Stalker.
Yeah.
There you go. That's a good one. Last week, we also watched Guardians of the Galaxy and had a first-run movie. We got another one next week coming out, The Alien Covenant, and then a whole new summer lineup coming out. And then also Leftover Fargo, Better Call Saul, Lunch with Jim and Aaron, maybe a commissioned podcast this week or next. Who knows? Too much content for two humans to make, let alone one to consume at baldmove.com. Check out what's interesting to you.
All right. We start off with a flashback to Jimmy helping Chuck prepare his house for a visit from Rebecca, who doesn't know anything about his condition, apparently. And she, you know, they have a lovely dinner, and she ends up getting a call on her cell phone from her conductor, which she takes, and this, you know, freaks Chuck out, and he grabs the phone and he throws it on the floor, which freaks Rebecca out, and she ends up leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the last time that they have spoken since then.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed watching this scene and trying to place it contextually within the timeline of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of questions, right? Like, Chuck and Jimmy are still on decent terms, all right? Jimmy's here helping him out. Rebecca and Chuck, though, are not. So this is somewhere between their divorce and the stuff that's gone down with Jimmy.
There was some debate about whether this was even post-divorce. Like, maybe this was a separation and the divorce wasn't final, which is why Chuck was trying to decide whether he should wear the ring or not. 'Cause if you're... divorced for any amount of time, and you're debating about whether to wear your wedding ring around your ex-wife, I mean, that is so desperate and thirsty and weak that I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, but I don't know that Chuck is not that person who's trying to send signals without saying a thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's trying to show that I'm holding a torch for you,
right?
Which actually is hundreds of candles. But yeah, you're right. Regardless, it does seem like it is sometime after the dinner that we saw last year.
Absolutely.
And we still don't know. So how does this change how we think of the timeline? Because I know one of the early speculations was that Chuck's illness was caused by Rebecca leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And another one was, well, Chuck's illness was caused by Jimmy getting his law degree. They still seem like they're just playing this nebulous enough that you can't tell. He's got the disease at this point. He's hiding it from his ex-wife. He'd rather look like an asshole than to show that he's got a mental problem. But I wasn't quite sure about if that gives us more evidence about whether the thing was caused by his wife or his brother or both contributing together.
I mean, both of those things have transpired already, right? Mm-hmm. So there's really no way it doesn't lend us any more insight into that.
Right. But Jimmy said also, you know, when he broke the tape, it's like, you know, you're crazy. No wonder Rebecca left. Implying that, you know, that his brother's behavior might have been getting kind of to extremes that led up to that.
Yeah, possibly.
I don't know. I thought, what did you think of the look? Because number one, holy blue filter, Batman. Like, I think we might have said this last year because sometimes that blue pass filter, especially when combined with Charles's cave-like setting, mm-hmm. makes it very inky and murky looking.
Yeah.
But I thought this was a really good looking scene, and listening to the Insider podcast, they got out their Panasonic Varicam again, which is capable, like they only lit it with candles, which is really incredible.
Wow. Yeah.
And you can actually, if you're interested in technology, you can, if you Google like Panasonic Varicam, spelled V-A-R-I, low light test there, they do a whole bunch of tests versus a conventional camera and then all the different ISO settings. And it's just amazing what you can do with night shots and candlelight and stuff that you just can't do with a conventional camera.
Yeah, I think they really needed it for Chuck's house because Chuck's house, like you said, has always been maybe a little too dark for the screen for my taste.
And then when you start filtering it and doing things, it starts looking, but yeah.
There's a lot of other stuff in here that happens. Like, you get the impression that a lot of this is Jimmy's idea. That the reuniting of Rebecca and Chuck is something that Chuck wants, but something that Jimmy made happen.
Specifically, I disagree, but I want to hear your support.
Specifically because I don't think Chuck comes up with this plan on his own. I think this is a Jimmy plan. It has his signature all over it. And, in fact, if you believe that, and I don't know that there's like hard evidence to support that, but if you believe that, then it makes a lot of sense as to why Chuck would have immediately suspected that Jimmy tampered with that paperwork. Because in this scene, we find out that the excuse that Chuck uses as to why the power's off is the transposition of an address.
Right.
So you can see where Chuck would file that away as, oh, this is one of Jimmy's schemes. And then next time it comes up, boom, he's on top of it.
That's pretty good. In my head canon, Chuck wanted this to happen, and he, you know, he's not practiced at lying and subterfuge and doing all this, so he brought on Jimmy as someone to help him out, and Jimmy's giving him advice like, look, are you sure you want to go this committed? Because my experience, the bigger the lie, the bigger the downside, and Chuck is steadfastly ignoring it, almost like he's a consultant brought on to help, but it wasn't his idea.
Okay, I guess... Yeah, I follow that. It makes sense.
And I think kind of what supports either interpretation.
But that's kind of more what I mean. Like, make it happen is not the right word necessarily, but I'm sure he made the phone calls. Yeah. He probably got in touch with her.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a letter sent.
And you can see how Chuck perks up because she's obviously been traveling the world in her role as a very important symphony conductor, if you've forgotten what she does.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, she's a violinist.
Oh, really? I thought she was the conductor.
No, because her conductor calls her.
Ah, got you, scene. Got you. All right.
So she plays an instrument in a symphony.
All right.
Flute, an oboe, the drums.
Well,
I forget what she plays.
Yeah,
a
I mean,
clarinet,
we've
a
seen,
tuba.
We've seen Chuck use a metronome, and there's a piece called the Rebecca that wasn't
yeah.
there? Like, and
there
I don't
was
know. If
on the
okay.
Piano.
So does that say that she's a pianist? I honestly don't know, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I thought she. God damn, I thought she was a conductor. Anyway, he really perks up the idea of her wanting to lay down roots and set up a U.S. residency mm-hmm. after these years of, it seems like years of wandering.
Yeah.
The further your discussion about the chronology. I also thought it was, it was impressive. Oh, go ahead. I don't want to switch subjects.
Yeah. Let's stay on that for a second. Does that imply that maybe the tension there was not necessarily all from Chuck, but it maybe was from both sides? Like, she's being pulled away by this job. He can't deal with the time alone, I guess.
Right, and just a loss of like the lack of control.
Yeah.
And I can see, like, yeah, look, I'm going to go travel the world, and you're going to stay here in Albuquerque, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to do a long distance relationship open ended for years and years. It's dumb.
Right.
I'm going to go, you know, pound some Spanish guys or Chinese guys.
Why would Chuck
want to
pound Spanish guys? He could probably pound as many Spanish guys
Rebecca,
as he wants.
Rebecca.
In Albuquerque.
Rebecca.
Oh, Rebecca?
Yeah.
Okay.
She pounds them.
Okay.
I don't know how that goes on. But yeah, clearly Chuck has control issues, and the fact that someone would be wandering the world in a successful career away from his sphere would bother him.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought it was very interesting how, when he slapped a phone out of her hand and he covered up with, like, well, this is just bad manners, how kind of, I mean, clearly the situation had been fucked up.
Right.
But she wasn't just like, you know what, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Like I would be.
I was a little surprised at that.
Like I don't even know, like, if I were, like, if in otherwise I was in good terms with someone and someone slapped my cell phone out of my hands and said it's bad form to take a phone call, I think I'd be quick with the, you know what, go fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself with your Miss Manners and your salad forks and your goddamn Chilean sea bass. And I thought it showed how much esteem and affection she has that she just didn't immediately be like, you know what, fuck you.
Yeah, and also the pride from Chuck, you know, the unwillingness to admit that he could ever be less than perfect.
But that was also a linchpin because it was a way to Jimmy to reinforce the fact that this was a mental situation and that Chuck knows it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he says, like, if this had been lung cancer, if this had been any kind of physical problem, you wouldn't have any problem telling your ex-wife about it. But, what is the difference between the electromagnetic allergy and lung cancer?
Potato, potato.
Yeah, indeed.
I do like how, in a sort of reprisal of the mic gag from last episode, Rebecca seems to be chasing him around the house with his phone.
Yeah, right.
Which I thought was pretty funny.
Accidentally. And his whole face, like, when he's mugging on that, I don't know. I liked it.
Yeah.
And I enjoy seeing Chuck suffer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I do admit it.
You know? It's not like I'm pulling for Chuck or anything, but yeah. The one other line from this that seemed important to me is when Jimmy says, you know, from his experience, the bigger the lie, the harder it can be to dig out. And Chuck says, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. And that bridge never came, right?
Mm-hmm.
Up until this very episode in the courtroom or in the hearing room, that moment never came. He never tried to dig out, and he just kept piling the lies on bigger and bigger. Until finally it erupted in this.
But it
this
does connect the two family dramas because this was a minor lie and caper that Jimmy pulled to help out someone that he cares about and to preserve their business and preserve their standing at a very slight cost to someone else. So it's almost like it's all part of the same scam. Like, he's crossing the bridge right now. Because something that he was comfortable in doing, and I get it. It's a little bit worse to actually do this and embarrass someone legally to get a job back. But on the other hand, you know, we could relitigate this whole situation.
Right.
But I thought it was really interesting how it kind of that tied those two together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, as much as Chuck would protest, they're somewhat similar, these two brothers.
The big question at the end of this episode is, does Chuck realize he's been beat and give up, or does this instigate an even larger countercon?
Right.
And where does it begin? Because, like, Jim, this is an open-ended question. The bigger the lie,
yeah,
the harder it is to dig yourself out. Well, neither one of them have dug out yet, so
yeah.
Now what?
Yeah. So Jimmy goes over to the vet to find someone with the lightest of touches who doesn't need to fit into tight spaces, and we will see who that is later.
Now, you got that was Huel immediately,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, God. And so I like this kind of reveal because they put this thing. It's very like I enjoy seeing Jimmy build his tool set of all these nefarious underground. And the fact that we already knew from Breaking Bad that Huel had surprisingly light touch for a man whose fingers are the size of hot dogs.
Right.
And like all that knowledge goes in and you're anticipating it, where you open a door and it's Raymond Cruz as Tuco. It's like,
right.
Okay.
Seems to be there only for the cameo.
Exactly. But this made a lot of sense, and I was fucking so excited to see Huel. And when he finally shows up, I just about exploded. It's awesome.
All right. We will get there very shortly. Kim tells Mesa Verde about the upcoming press that they might see about Jimmy's case, and they think Chuck is just essentially refusing to own up to his own mistakes. And Kim reassures them that Mesa Verde isn't connected in any way to this case. Now, I'm not sure I agree with you, Kim.
It's hard for me to see from where I'm sitting right now how Mesa Verde will be connected, because how are they going to prove that Kim had knowledge of this caper, and how could this reflect poorly on Mesa Verde? And even if it I don't know who the president of Mesa Verde is. I can't remember his name. But he came out so strong. Makes me think that even if Jimmy were disbarred and disgraced and he might just be like, well, this is just, of course Chuck did this. He's got all these powerful contacts and friends that he fucking bragged about in his thing, and he shit the bed, and he can't take it like a man. Like, I don't know that there's anything, except they linger on Kim's friend's concern a little too long for me to think that this isn't going to come back on it.
Right.
What I'm worried about is it's going to come back on it, and I'm just not going to buy it. In a lot of the ways that I have some problems with the basic premise of the caper going on here.
Okay.
Like, great television, but I'm not sure about the details. I hope that there is a direct straight line, like tightening of a noose that we're going to appreciate over to several episodes, and then when it finally hits, it's going to be like, oh my God, instead of like, what?
Yeah. I do think this is a foreshadowing scene. Otherwise, why even include it?
It has to be.
Yeah.
Like, you can include it just because we'd wonder. But the friend's concern at the end, after the baby's been put to bed, that's the thing that's got me scared for Kim and her career.
Right. Then we go over to the disbarment hearing, which begins with opening statements. Wait, no. Chuck and Howard need to prepare the room first.
There you go.
They go into the hearing room and inspect it to make sure it will fit Chuck's needs. Howard tries to talk Chuck into not testifying. This is interesting to me because I think Howard correctly suspects Jimmy's plan here. He doesn't think there's any good in having Chuck testify because Chuck is a wild card.
Right.
To Howard.
Right.
And, that card gets played eventually.
And Howard, like, he is deeply concerned this entire episode.
Yeah.
Like, and it seems like he's entirely correct. If Chuck had just let everybody else testify, it would have been ironclad noose around Jimmy's neck, and you got clear criminal behavior and potential cover-up.
Yeah.
And, he is a liability to this case.
I mean, that's the thing. Jimmy is essentially playing on people's sympathy here, right? Like,
right.
Chuck says he's been doing his entire life.
Right.
Oh, poor Jimmy,
Right.
Innocent, sweet Jimmy. Everybody loves Jimmy. And that's essentially where he's going with this case.
Yeah.
My brother hates me. Feel bad for me. Don't disbar me.
Right. This is also the first of the many great homages love letters to great courtroom dramas. There's a quote from here from the JFK. Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall.
Okay.
Something
yeah.
that Jim Garrison says as he's about to essentially put on trial the entire government, United States government apparatus about on the assassination of JFK. So I thought that was pretty good. And there's others, but clearly you know, Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan, huge fans of pop culture, and they love all this courtroom shit. And they don't, for a show about a lawyer, they don't get to do a lot of courtroom drama.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
So they're like really flexing their muscles, and they're putting in all these little references and homages. And I thought that was a good one.
Yeah, and one of the things that I heard in the Insider cast is they liked the sort of latitude they had, this being a bar hearing right. instead of an actual court case.
Right.
They took some liberties.
Right.
So they had a little more fun than they might have gotten
yeah,
to.
Yeah, it's
in
like
an actual court.
I think they're too professional that if they were trying to do a courtroom drama that they could just, you know, do whatever.
Yeah.
But since it's kind of a quasi courtroom trial, they're able mm-hmm. to do all the drama without a lot of rigorous research.
Yeah.
Which I think suits them well.
So the disbarment hearing begins with opening statements and Howard's testimony. Kim's cross-examination reveals that Chuck blocked Jimmy from being hired as a lawyer at HHM. Of course, we already knew that, but that comes out to the court,
right?
To the panel of judges here.
I thought Kim did a great job making smart objections and her cross, and the fact yeah. that she blows apart the nepotism defense because, you know, like that's... How does he say it with a straight face with the HH and M and him being yeah. the lowercase H?
That's her point. Yeah.
Yeah. It gets him flat footed and he can't do anything. He can't do anything. But I do like the fact I can talk about his other employment at the firm Davis and Main if you'd like.
Yeah. No, that was excellent.
Oh, that won't be necessary.
And then she's just like, no. Yeah. No, I don't want you to do
moving
that.
On.
I'm going to lean on our legal counsel for this FMLA thing. I'm sure they have something to say about it. What this FMLA leave is.
I don't think
so.
It's the Family Medical Leave Act.
Is that
which,
what it is?
Okay. Which essentially provides, says that if, you know, like it's mostly for, I think, pregnancy or I guess if you, but it's for essentially if you have a medical condition that keeps you from working, they have to keep your job open for a certain appointed amount of time. And I think it's also, you know, like any other medical issue, confidential.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Like Chuck couldn't say, oh, yeah, Howard couldn't say, oh, yeah, Chuck went cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over electricity, and he's been living in a cave ever since and never sets foot in the office.
Right.
And as a result of that, keeps reams of confidential documents in an unsecured area. I mean, there's been a little bit of talk about maybe what actually happens is the ultimate judo flip of Chuck being disbarred.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know. It's
yeah, I don't think the pieces aren't there.
Right.
Like, it's more, so this is what Howard is worried about, right? This idea that HHM is somehow responsible, or irresponsible, rather, with their documents and their chains of evidence and all kinds of stuff.
Well, and also Chuck is just like, well, this is a PR issue, and Howard patiently explains how actually the opposite could be true. This could blow mm-hmm. up. This could be a public relations nightmare. And then it's like, well, the law is too important. He can just flip flop back and forth between those two rationales. It's an argument that Howard clearly can't win.
Yeah. So Chuck practices his description of Jimmy, in the window at home, and the tape is played. In the hearing room, then the room is prepared for Chuck, who bumps into Huell on his way to the hearing room.
This son of a bitch, like
which one, Chuck or Huell?
No, Huell's cool.
Okay,
I'm tolerably pleased with Huell appearing on the scene.
Yeah,
but like you know, the fact that they just like they dim the lights, they take the clock off the wall, they've got like a primo spot reserved for him so he doesn't have to spend any more time out in the sunlight and electromagnetic radiation than he has to. Just like, God damn this guy.
I did wonder what the lingering on the reserved parking was all about.
I think it's just so beginning. You see what kind of red carpet treatment he's getting.
Right, right. I wonder what it was about the first time they showed it, because when they showed Jimmy and Kim walking in,
right.
Now it all makes sense when right. Chuck pulls up.
And it has you, I will say all this stuff with Huell and Rebecca, like it even had me guessing. Mm-hmm. And then when they had the flip-flop of Jimmy having his phone but no battery, I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. In the end it all makes sense. We'll talk about it. So Huell here looking, you know, his head looks as Huell-ish as ever.
Mm-hmm.
His head is maybe even a little bit more mountainous.
Mm-hmm.
But the man himself has become, I would say, a large hill rather than a mountain, which is interesting because – so the actor has lost some weight,
mm-hmm.
which means the character put on a shitload of weight
right.
in the time between now and Breaking Bad.
Right.
Which I think is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I am happy for the guy because from all accounts, he's got a medical issue and he's lost like 150, 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And that's all good. But for Huel, the character, I don't...
Hashtag not my Huel.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, it's like, I read Alan Sepinwall's review, and he's like, I hope they make some kind of gratuitous mention of the character eating and people being concerned about him gaining weight. And I'm like,
I don't
know if that's the appropriate thing. And if you think about this guy's real-life struggle, if that's actually... I mean, I'm sure Sepinwall didn't think about all those angles, and God knows I've said stupider things. But, I mean, I'm fine with poking weight at, you know, Odenkirk, you know, losing a bit more hair and getting older, because that's something we all go through. But, you know, this guy's he's fighting a good fight, so...
I don't need the mentions of him eating sandwiches constantly.
No, I'm good with Huel at any weight.
Yeah, yeah.
And the less they say about it on the show, I think, is the better, as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Chuck gets on the stand. His condition is brought up, and he's asked if he hates his brother. He says, no, of course, I love my brother. He's just bad for the law. They take a short recess, during which Rebecca shows up. Chuck realizes what Jimmy's up to, but it doesn't stop it from goading him into showing his true anger at his brother when Jimmy demonstrates that his illness is all in his head. And this is kind of the final scene here. It's a long scene.
Yeah, I thought them getting Rebecca was going to be putting her on a stand so she could testify. Like, and when they showed his outburst at the phone, like, oh, this is a slam dunk. But it's kind of we had this written out, but I also got it right away. It's a Frankie Pentangelo kind of a factor from The Godfather, where you bring this relative that's supposed to be like, you know, supposed to put you on notice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Frankie Five Angels gets it right away. Chuck just bullies ahead. In fact, I think it's funny how, from Rebecca's perspective, Jimmy's work calls and he's worried about his brother, and all this is the truth. And you need to come, and he's having this disease, and he hasn't told you because he's too proud. And Chuck immediately starts going on and saying, well, that's just my brother trying to take advantage, and oh, it's not going to... And to Rebecca, she must think this is lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kim says, you know she's going to hate you after this, I'm like, why? From her perspective, this is just Chuck acting like a fucking crazy person.
Yeah, but if someone used you, manipulated you into a scenario where you were sort of the linchpin of a case that brought down someone you cared about, I think maybe you get a little bit
annoyed. But what's the evidence that she's actually being used?
Well, I mean, the whole point of having her there is to rattle Chuck, which he points out, he knows, but it works nonetheless.
That's what he asserts, but he asserts a lot of crazy-ass things that I don't think...
But I think he's right in that scenario.
Here's the hell that is Chuck's existence. He is, when he goes on this long monologue about Jimmy and how crazy he is and how diabolical he is, he's entirely right, with the possible exception of him robbing his parents blind.
Possibly, but we just don't know.
We don't know, and like, that's going to be a big, you say, linchpin. It's going to be a big linchpin in the season because either Jimmy has been robbing his parents blind since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worse than the fact that he saw his father as being weak and his father just being taken advantage of. And he's like, you know, why not? That this is like some kind of like really malicious thing that bankrupted his father. Or that's the original sin that Chuck made up. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that caused all the fraternal friction. And it's going to be whether you see Saul as fundamentally a terrible person or a flawed person who didn't ever have a chance because his brother just never gave him one. That I think the series is gonna hang on that. I hope Jimmy's innocent of that original crime, and you know, you can then see him being pushed into his box by his brother throughout his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
If not, I'm gonna have to reevaluate how I feel about Jimmy from the bottom up.
Sure, yeah. I actually saw a really what I think is a really good analysis of Chuck on Reddit. And it's something that we've kind of hinted around at over the years. But I think it was especially spot on because you can imagine a scenario where – and you don't even have to do much imagining. You mm-hmm. see a scenario playing out on the screen throughout their history where Chuck kind of values his identity as the opposite of Jimmy in a lot of ways, right? Because he's seen, you know, the Jimmy constantly gets away with all these things and everybody loves Jimmy and he doesn't receive the same attention. And so he tries to be the exact opposite of Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jimmy's always breaking the rules. So Chuck goes the other way and says, I'm going to be the guy who always follows the rules.
He's older brother. Why is this a reaction? I think Chuck is what Chuck is, a cold kind of detached person and has no, like, he wants to be loved.
But imagine you're the older brother and your young baby brother is getting all of the
attention.
Yeah, it's
fucking Cain and Abel. It's literally a story as old as time. Like,
right,
so what?
Okay, so now imagine that same person that you've spent your entire life being the opposite of becomes you one day and takes your identity from you.
Yeah, you should.
A lawyer. Of course that would enrage you.
That might take years of therapy to unravel, and you might become a better person rather than retreating into the armor of shit that Chuck wears.
But you have zero empathy for this character. Zero? Entirely no empathy for Chuck as a human being. I can't understand that.
I don't. Yes, an adult taking a childhood grudge into adulthood and not having any sympathy towards Jimmy, I do have a hard time empathizing with that.
Okay, I think it's natural. I think that's what people do.
I do think that's what people do, but also,
and I don't think they're in control of it. They can just make the decision not to do it.
I also think that, but like, also fucking get help. Mm-hmm. Like, if this is an albatross around your neck that's, like, taking you down to the bottom of a dark place, then fucking get some help. And I guess the other question is, obviously Chuck has a real mental problem,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Like this psychosomatic disease, I don't think it's as cynical as people say it. Like that he can just I think he can play it up a little bit, and I think he can, you know, play it down. I don't think those are all at his conscious control either. I think mm-hmm. the man is sick and he needs some help. And also Jimmy's been an enabler if you want to, like, really muddy the waters. So it's I don't have no sympathy from Chuck. I'm just saying that, goddamn, it's a pretty maladaptive living strategy that he has decided to take with him into advanced middle age rather than trying to fix at any point in time.
Sure.
Ignoring wake up call after wake up call.
I totally agree with that, but I don't. Like, I also think the same is true of alcoholism or any drug-related problem. Like, there are so many conditions that you can have that it's easy to say, just go get help. Like, make the fucking adult choice here and just fix your fucking life.
Right.
That's easy to say. It's not easy to do.
Yeah, so I try to look at it a balanced perspective. Like, I do have sympathy for the addict or for sympathy for the person who's dealing with a personal or emotional issue. But I can also say, you know, people can and do overcome these things.
Sure.
And, you know, like something my therapist said is an adult is entitled to all the pain in life that they want. So when you've had enough, well, then you can say that you've hit rock bottom or you've had a wake up call. You can describe you can describe that as very many ways. Like, but eventually a person has enough and says, you know, enough is enough. I'm going to try to get help and it probably won't work the first time. And it's going to take a lot of hard work. But until you start that journey, you're still just on this downward spiral. So. Yeah. I guess my feelings, like I said, are complicated. Like, I have sympathy for those people, but also a little bit of, you know, it's also not like I have sympathy for the drug addict, but I also really feel for the parents that they've stolen, you know, they've taken this their child in for the 13th time and he's stolen their silverware, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Like it's a shitty situation all around.
Yeah.
There is room for...
Like Jesse.
There is room for pitying the genetic and socioeconomic status to put the person in the room, and there's also room for personal responsibility.
Sure.
And also, so, hashtag fuck Chuck.
Yeah, I've...
Because this is a television show, this isn't a real person, so fuck Chuck. So yeah.
I don't like anything he's doing either, but... You know, I
and
try
the sanctimonious,
and I try and contextualize,
like,
everything.
You know, oh, it's like a peanut allergy. Oh, it's like AIDS and HIV, and no one's discovered just yet. And all, you know, like, here's the thing that drives me crazy about Chuck. Since we're on the subject, this guy's got a fine legal and analytical mind, and he's never thought to do some double blind experiments on himself. Like, doctors aren't fucking listening to you, so like, why don't you? why don't you try to start, like, you know, trying to figure out the state of the art of this thing? But he doesn't, because it's not a real, you know, because it's a mental issue, and we go around and he's pitied and fuck Chuck, so.
So the thing that I think is the end game here is to completely dismiss this tape as evidence of any kind of, as evidence, honestly, of the crimes, because what Chuck says here during his cross-examination is that this was just a piece of play acting, theater.
And
the exact same thing applies to Jimmy.
And I don't see why that's a hard sell.
It's not. And I think next episode that's going to come into play. I think that's the end game.
Like, I do think that that's, like, even without all this fucking theatrics, like, here's the thing. All this theatrics attacks the legitimacy of the tape. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything about the ensuing crime. Now,
right.
I don't know how the justice system works, because I think that it would work on principles that, like, a common man would be like, oh, yeah, that's the way it works out. But so often it's not. But I don't see, like, and then maybe the bar panel can be like, well, in full 360-degree view of the facts, like, while he did commit a crime, this is not a crime of, like, you know, this isn't a criminal trying to conceal his actions. This is a frustrated brother who tried to do his brother a solid, and his brother further retreated into his delusion.
Absolutely.
And this is a guy who's like, you know what? It's you're not going to fuck up my life and my career over your craziness.
Yeah.
I don't know why we needed all this theatrics to get to there, because it just seems like that's also a plain reading of the facts. But because if it's just a factual nature, nothing's going to change the fact that Jimmy broke into this house and took a crowbar equivalent, vandalized his dresser, broke the thing, and advanced menacingly on Chuck before he was stopped by a private investigator and a concerned partner.
Right. I don't think that's the key, though.
Okay, if you pull in the emotions, then you didn't need any of the other shit, because it's just a plain reading supports the fact that this is a bunch of bullshit. So, again, not a lawyer. Also, hashtag fuck Chuck. I just don't. That's the problem I have with all this.
I think the thing that they're really trying to get at, and they mention it in the episode, is this tape actually evidence? Did Jimmy actually try to destroy evidence? And that's the ethical problem they have here, and the thing that would actually get him disbarred. So if they can establish that this is not evidence, in fact, and that Jimmy busted in because he felt betrayed by Chuck after he was trying to help him by telling a lie that made him feel better, I think then they can say the tape isn't even evidence of a crime.
Right.
Because just like Chuck was acting to get me to admit to the crime, I acted when I said that I committed the crime in the first place.
Right.
Because, look, my brother is insane. He was doing insane things.
Right.
I was trying to help him. And I think they're one step in a two-step process of explaining that whole situation.
Yeah, and I know the law has room for, you know, shades of nuance. Like, it reminds me of, like, this whole, like, you know, the court issue that the president's having getting this travel ban enacted. Like, if you look at the document itself, it doesn't say all Muslims are banned.
Right.
But if you look at his promises to where the first thing I'm going to do is enact a travel ban of all Muslims, and the judge is like, look, I'm not an idiot.
Yeah.
This, you can't sit there and, like, put a travel ban and say it's not about Muslims and then say that this is fulfilling a campaign promise to ban Muslims until you get it all, quote unquote, figured out. So I do understand that the legal system is not as black and white and as stupid as I often, like, make it out to be, but it's just, I just, it's weird. It's like, if this is based on the two brothers fighting in a squabble, I don't even understand why we're here. And it's based on the letter and the law. Like, because it does seem like the law does expect the citizens to, I've seen it time and time again that the law expects the citizens to have almost inhuman control over their emotions. And people, you know, get brought up on charges for shit that they did in a moment that no one really got hurt about. Yet it's like, well, you know, the jury's like, well, they imagine I wouldn't do that in that situation. And, like, bullshit, how can you say?
Yeah.
Anyway, fuck it. I'm this close to going on a rant about how we don't really have control over interactions, and science shows that we react and then rationalize in our brain seconds afterwards, and then, you know, what are you going to do?
Are we living?
Is there an objective reality? Can anyone be responsible for anything they do? What's the point of the criminal justice system?
Yep.
You know, et cetera.
These are all things we're going to save for House of Cards. So let me ask you this. Were you bothered at all by Jimmy being able to cross-examine Chuck?
I think this is where the Gilligan and Gould cloak comes in, where yeah. they're just like, this isn't a real trial. This is co-counsel. Mm-hmm. And also, it sounds like, because Peter Gould's sister-in-law is a lawyer for Maine,
I think.
And they actually had a disbarment process that they watched all 6 hours of it, and this woman lost it, but she represented herself.
Uh-huh.
So it seems like, you know, I don't know how things work in New Mexico, and also I don't really give a shit. It crossed the barrier for me. Now, lawyers watching this might be like, what the fuck? We've got a couple feedback about that, but I didn't have a problem with it.
And they did promise some latitude for the cross-examination earlier.
If anything, I thought, it seems like the whole plot of this is a real David and Goliath, that maximum latitude and understanding was extended towards Chuck. Minimum latitude and understanding was extended to Kim and Jimmy, and they mm-hmm. made the most of what they had.
Yeah. Like I mentioned before, great performance from Michael McKean in this scene, but in quintessential Breaking Bad style, I love how they do this time and time again. They introduce, in what is a extremely emotional and dramatic scene, just a hilarious line. The best line of the episode, in my opinion. He defecated through a sunroof.
Right. And it's just like all this amazing stuff we know is absolutely true, but it just sounds like the ravings of a madman that you're...
Totally.
You're connecting things he did as a 9-year-old boy with... Like, with that billboard, you're going to tell me that man fell off by accident? Pah! Like,
they don't even know about that. Just ranting.
It just sounds like a person being crazy.
It does.
And not play acting at all.
No, not here.
That was really great. And also, this is something mentioned in the Insider Podcast. We also have feedback on it. But a lot of modern audiences will recognize this kind of like emotional breakdown from like A Few Good Men, but also I watched a clip of the climax of the Caine Mutiny with Humphrey Bogart, and there's a similar issue where the guy just under relentless cross-examination gets him to forget himself and reveal how kind of fucked up his worldview is.
Yeah.
And what was really, I'm glad I watched the clip too, because it's almost like beat for beat how Chuck was played through this, the Humphrey Bogart playing Captain Queeg. It was very similar into the beats, into the camera work, and like it felt like a very overt homage.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, this plan is working despite Chuck realizing what the plan is, and actually, like, the cell phone thing, I thought was pointless to do the reveal, here's a cell phone and then here's a battery. But I think that further serves to throw Chuck off guard, because Chuck thinks he's caught him out, right?
Like, Chuck is on high alert for this kind of shit.
Right. I'm on to you. Yeah, the cell phone. Let me see that thing. Oh, it doesn't have a battery in it.
Right.
Of course. Just another gag. Right. Just another chicanery.
And it's another thing that he could not... it's just another layer of armor that he put around the plot, just because, you know...
Right.
Chuck is looking for the naked con, and then the hidden con, and then there's a con on top of the con he didn't see coming. Now, an interesting historical fact is that this director, first-time director for both Better Call Saul and Leftovers, Daniel Sackheim, directed both of the episodes of this week.
Really? Leftovers. Did he do Fargo?
And we'll see. We'll see. I don't know. But I just love the way he chose to, like, push in on Chuck. So he's just, he's just swelling with rage, and his face is getting bigger and bigger. And then once you see everyone's reactions, they pull out and make him look very small. Mm-hmm. And then also frame him from behind the exit sign, which is now buzzing and menacing. And that...
It's almost like throughout the episode, these exit signs have been imploring him, begging him to leave this room. Don't come in here.
Yeah, they're like a cautionary.
Right. And then
dead end sign.
And then he sort of realizes it at the end. Maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah. Yeah. But the man can compose a shot. Like, he's Maybe he is the one who won the week. Daniel Sackheim.
Okay. I mean, you can't go wrong with those two shows.
Right. And they both had really stellar ends this week. Very, very cinematic and cool. And like they also talk about this in Insider Podcast, how they've got this kind of boring government building that they found in this room, and it's very static, but just a mere, like when Chuck takes the stage, all the lights shut off, and it gives us like this like arch comic book villain. Like now everything is dark and drab, and it makes the room feel completely different than when like Howard's testifying or whatnot.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. And it's something that they just kind of backed into. I mean, that's the amazing thing. I was talking to someone in the feedback. I'm not going to read their message, but he's like, you know, how long did the Villa gang know about the, you know, like what Rebecca's role is going to be in this, and how, and the answer is they don't. Like coming into the season, they had no idea when Chuck and Rebecca got divorced, how their relationship was now, whether Chuck's illness was caused by that, what her relationship was to Jimmy. They just knew what they had committed to film and, you know, their characters, and they work backwards from that to get where they want. And it's really like they're these gifted improv artists that just keep making shit up, but it makes it seem like they're fucking geniuses.
Yeah.
Like, oh, shit that they set up, you know, blah, 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 so many seasons ago in another fucking television shows. No, they're just students of their own history. And that's right. Why they're so, that's why, and they give a shit, and they care, and that's why it's so good.
Yep. Anything else?
I think that will do.
Okay, why don't we get into some feedback?
I am here to tell you about the fantastic deal that is club.baldmove.com.
You're really going to have to sell it to me.
This commercial is taking place at a stately pace because we've done a lot of research, and we see that fans of Better Call Saul appreciate the slow burn that leads up to the payload of enjoyment. Mm-hmm. If you go to club.baldmove.com, not only do you get the smug Chuck-like satisfaction of supporting independent and free podcast, the pinnacle of human civilization, the fact that two middle-aged white men can have their voices heard on the internet free of any kind of legal or sponsorship encumbrance. Like, only you can make that happen, and it's something to be smugly satisfied, but you also get a lot out of it. Leading up to what I'm here, the pitch that you presumably you'd be excited about. We got this thing that we do every first Wednesday called Quit Your Pitching, and Jim and I, we go to the internet, and there's several generate random television show name generators that you can generate random television show names with. See how I just kind of
they're
like,
aptly named, really.
Like I took what I said before and I repeated it, and it's just to keep the stately pace going.
Are you using the rule of thirds? Is that what I'm hearing?
It's rule of thirds. Okay. And we generate these names, and then we just, without any kind of preparation, we turn on the microphones and we pitch them at each other. And we cut out the crap, and we keep the gold, and we deliver it to the club members. We've actually take a snippet, which was Hardcastle and Stalker. Where we cast Brian Dennehy opposite of fan favorite John Leguizamo. He's got a bionic leg.
Well, his name Leguizamo.
Walker Texas Ranger comes in for an assist at the end. There's roundhouse kicks. If you think it's funny and you want more, you can go to club.baldmove.com. You get a little sizzle with your steak. You get a little Jimmy with your Chuck. Hashtag fuck Chuck. But mostly club.baldmove.com. Jesse K, on your latest podcast, he's talking about last week. We got a few last week. You say there's no concrete way to determine the year it's taking place, but a couple episodes ago in Jimmy's arraignment hearing, the court docket number is read CR 2013, blah, 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 blah. Criminal docket codes in New Mexico, as well as other states, have the year of the criminal charge. Thus, they deliberately are saying the season is 2013.
That can't be true.
That's impossible.
Yeah, because Breaking Bad takes place in 2008.
And the one thing Vince and Peter aren't super close about is their cultural references, because if you search for Breaking Bad chronology, you'll go to, or Breaking Bad timeline, you'll go to the official Breaking Bad Wikipedia that lists no less than 13 timeline inconsistencies. And one of the glaring ones is when a person mentions about, oh, they, in the final season of Breaking Bad, they didn't have this much trouble tracking down Bin Laden.
Yep.
When in Showtime, Bin Laden would not be tracked down and killed for another 2 years.
Right.
And there's a lot of things like, you know, there's a poster that says that Los Pollos Hermanos has the best burrito of 2010, even though it's really 2009. Mm. They fuck up. They're not perfect.
Yeah.
So that's just another one of those what you call fuck ups.
Yeah.
Because clearly this is, I think we've talked about this is like in a 2001 kind of timeline. That's official and everything else is just an inconsistency. Joseph S. took issue with our being coy about Nacho and who he's working for. Nacho's obviously working for Gus. I mean, come on, the knowing looks passed between the two of them in Sabrecido should be enough, but if we think back to Mike's attempt to kill Hector, the connection becomes obvious. It explains how Gus ever becomes aware of Mike. Nacho tells Gus about him. Nacho is clearly intentionally blocking Mike's headshot at the behest of Gus. Oh, clearly?
Clearly.
Nacho is smart enough to know that Hector's branch of the cartel is heading for a swift demise, so working with Gus would provide him a safe landing place when Hector's branch inevitably implodes. My prediction, though, is that Hector finds out about Nacho's betrayal and has him killed, and during the attempt, either Mike or Gus attempt to save Nacho, and Hector is paralyzed as a result. Okay. What you have there is a theory that has a lot of stuff going for it, but it's not obvious nor clear nor anything like that.
I mean, I think the one thing that makes it some... Yeah, I don't think it is clear, actually.
I mean, I think you're right. I think that Nacho is working for Gus, but there is no direct... You have a lot of circumstantial evidence, and also it would make sense for him to do so. Because he wanted Mike to kill... or put Tuco away and then kill Hector, and then that would solve his problems. And when he didn't do that, what would a smart, resourceful guy like Nacho do? There, I'm making some theories, but they're not proven yet. And you know, you're probably going to be right, but also maybe Vince and Peter have something else up their sleeve. But I just want to point that out that like. I think you're right, but there's the difference between, a theory and what's actually obvious and what's actually been proven. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, and a show about ostensibly the law, circumstantial evidence other than my own will not be considered.
Andrew from Cincinnati. Every week I think, it's the last of the pea foods theory.
No.
And every week someone sends in something.
Mike wasn't even in this one.
Hey guys, I wanted to say that the Mike P. Foods theory is even more technically not dead, as an apple is actually a group of food known as a pome.
Right,
it's in the same family as pears, so the same way that if you were eating raspberries, you could say berries, eating apples, you could say he's eating pomes. And he links to a Wikipedia article that, apparently pears, apples, they're all pomes. So the P theory is still alive.
Is that related to the pomegranate?
Might. Because pome is actually the French word for apple, I guess, as well.
And pomegranate, of course, means granite apple.
Yep, means stone, rocky apple.
Yep.
Because they're just not worth eating.
They're not.
It takes so much time to fucking prepare them.
Yep.
And also, I know that's not necessarily true because I've seen the YouTube video of a guy breaking them down in five. I get it. I'm making a joke. Moving on, Lisa W.
I've seen somebody break down a cow in 5 seconds, though. So.
I just saw some Maori dude strip down a coconut with his fucking teeth in 5 seconds. It was crazy. It was crazy.
Wow.
It's like in the Fantastic Mr. Fox when Mr. Fox was eating toast.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm like, gee, how many teeth did you leave behind in that husk, dude?
Yeah.
Woo. That guy knew how to break down a coconut. Okay, Lisa W. said, just finished a podcast for 304. While you talked a little about Kim's social engineering game to suss out Chuck's home repair appointment, you didn't mention her finger hovering over one entry in the Yellow Pages, Lenny's repair.
Because this reference is too old for me. I don't have the proper context to talk about it.
What do you mean? Isn't Lenny the repair? Isn't that the vacuum repair vacuum cleaner?
Oh, shop? Is it? I thought it was a reference to an old TV show.
Flowers for Algernon?
No. No, I can't remember the name of it because it's before my time. But
I thought that was the name of the guy's vacuum cleaner repair.
It might be, yeah.
So if there's a deeper meaning and I'm wrong, then double dumbass on me. Okay, Chris B. from Yorkshire, recently went to watch Gus's introduction to Breaking Bad, but obviously because it's that good, I'm now up to mid-season 4 and sleep-deprived because of it. Yep, that's what happens. That's what happens when you start a Breaking Bad binge.
Yep.
Anyway, it got me thinking, given all the cameos which are appearing now, surely is a good shout-out for a future one. Could it be anyone's favorite coffee-making vegan, Gail Boetticher? The problem is, as we've mentioned last episode, you've got about 4 years of heel cooling before you even get to Breaking Bad's timeline.
Right.
And I used to be really excited for Walt and Jesse to show up in the margins, but when I actually started looking at the intended timeline and how much space is there to go, you might get a picture. You might get some Walt cameo as a high school chemistry teacher, but unless we have a huge time jump between one of these seasons, you're just not going to see, you know, Walt and Jesse dragging Saul out to the desert. You're not going to see, you know, you might, we might see Bill Burr's character, because, you know, like that's one of the things I'm really enjoying is seeing Saul pick up all these guys and, you know, the Jim Beaver's gun dealer, like that stuff is all fair game.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, contemporary guys like Gail Boetticher, I mean, you could see him, but he won't be Gus's meth cook. Right.
I mean, yeah. So we know that he built out. No, he didn't even build out the lab, did he? The super lab?
Yeah. No, I think he designed it. Because we see him, like, I think.
Okay, we see him unpacking all the crates.
I think he
literally
designed the space because all that stuff is in his lab notebook.
I guess it depends on
unpacking his stuff. I think, so my recollection is Gail is the beneficiary of one of Gus's scholarships. So Gus tapped him just like he did Max to like cook this meth, and he said, "Hey, Gail, if you wanted a super meth lab, what would it look like?"
Right. I guess I don't know when that happened exactly.
Yeah.
How long Gus had been in business before Walt.
And that's the other thing that's goofy about Breaking Bad is, you know, if Gail just wasn't so enamored of Walter White's product, the 99.1% pure, none of this would have ever happened.
Right.
Gail would have been happily cooking coffee and meth under the New Mexico, you know, laundromat for who knows how many decades.
Yeah. I mean, the other cameo we could see is Lydia. She's hovering around there somewhere in Gus's operation.
Yeah. We could see the neo-Nazis. Like, that would be an acceptably fun cameo. See Uncle, what was his name? Uncle Hitler and Devil.
Meth Damon.
And Meth Damon. Yeah. Meth Damon might be too young to plausibly make a cameo.
He might be, yeah.
Because Jesse Plemons ain't getting any younger or svelter.
So these guys are just pest control at this point, right? Like,
no,
they go in under these tents and they just steal stuff.
But I don't think that's the neo-Nazis. They were not Vominos Pest Control.
I know that's where he got the idea for it.
No, you think Vominos Pest Control is a neo-Nazi thing? I thought that's just where the Meth Damon is working because he's too stupid to join the gang.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I thought so.
Poor Meth Damon.
Yeah.
I don't even remember his actual name from the show.
Todd.
Todd, okay.
Fucking Todd. Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's move on or we'll just fall down a Breaking Bad hole poor Chris did. Jeremy R. from South Carolina. If you had lung cancer, would you have told her then? Maybe one of my favorite lines in Better Call Saul so far. Oddly specific reference. While I'm not positive of the reason for bringing Rebecca into, or I'm sorry, let's not make that a question. I'm not positive for the reason for bringing Rebecca to court. Was it to prove the condition was a result of a mental breakdown from the divorce? I didn't quite get the complete payoff there. Maybe there'll be further implications in the future.
I mean, the payoff there is just to rattle Chuck.
Yeah.
It makes him angry.
And even though he saw it coming because of the multi-stage rope-a-dope.
Yeah.
He couldn't entirely shrug off the stress and the tension from that encounter.
I mean, that's the thing. The whole reason this is happening is because Jimmy continues to get away with his schemes, right? And so he gets away with yet another scheme right in the courtroom in front of everyone, and that just sets Chuck off. It's beautiful.
Is this a true turning point in the Jimmy Chuck storyline? Do you guys think that there will be another end of Chuck, or this is the end of Chuck and will now focus on how Jimmy moves on past his brother? Or is this another battle in the long war? The final shot with the exit sign seems to signal that Chuck is done. I kind of hope so, but I'm now thinking, what if Chuck doubles down and goes even crazier trying to bring down Jimmy, and he gets himself in the con that might get himself killed? Because
yeah,
you
could
go
happen.
Because Jimmy had to go to the criminal underworld to set this con up. And if you go on a bigger con, eventually you're going to start hanging out with more and more unsavory characters. And I don't think Chuck is ready for that.
No, he's not.
He's too soft and not nearly street smart enough to navigate all this bullshit.
Right. And too prideful and all the reasons it wouldn't work.
I don't think he's done yet. I do hope he's done after this season.
That's the thing. It depends on how this turns around on Chuck. I could see him potentially being committed. I could see him going harder here, and maybe not in the criminal way, but like trying to go after Kim now. You know, Jimmy really stuck it to him with Rebecca.
Right.
Now I could see Chuck trying to stick it to Kim just to get back at him.
How can he do that?
I don't know. I mean, this idea that Mesa Verde is not connected really seems ominous.
But it's not. It's connected through Jimmy, but not through Kim.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know legally where that sets, but it seems like, you know, if someone commits a crime on my behalf that I did not ask them to do, how can that, like, is that some kind of bullshit fruits from the poisonous tree? Or, like, if I buy a stolen merchandise not knowing it's stolen, someone shows up and says that's stolen merchandise, they can still take it from me.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's not an ultimate shield, but, you know, surely there's fucking limits to that.
Yeah, I would think so. And I don't see the wheels that could turn here to make that possible, but
that's why Vince is
could craft
so good.
Them. Yep.
David from North Carolina. I've officially taken the Walking Dead bald move tactic of listening to your podcast but not watching the show. 2 years ago when this show started, I was so excited because I thought I was going to be about the high-paced life of Saul, the sleazy lawyer for the underworld. I didn't mind season one as a bit of a prequel, but now it's been two more seasons, no Saul. This has also been one of the slowest burning shows I've ever watched, and I just can't handle it. I feel like the biggest error was not making the spinoff show around Gus, because this seems to be what people care way more about. Plus, Mike's storyline could easily still have been told, which people also like. I don't think anyone wanted the Jimmy McGill storyline. You two seem to still be drinking the Kool-Aid. It's actually a margarita today, but close. How would you guys pitch the show to someone who has never seen it or has bailed like me? My stock answer is, why force yourself to watch something you don't like?
Sure.
Like, I have my blind spots. Like, people say that Americans is one of the best shows in television. I don't like the experience of watching the damn thing. If someone tells me, like, I'll tell someone that, like, okay, if you want to watch The Wire, watch the first three or four episodes. And if you're like, then why force yourself? People are like, oh, what? I've got through the first season of Leftovers, and I'm not hooked. What should I do? Stop watching the fucking show. I think it's the best thing on television, but if you've seen the first season and you're not getting it, then you're not going to get it, man. And that's fine. Like, so much of this bullshit pop culture wars we get into is people just not wanting to admit that not everything is for everyone.
Right. If I were going to pitch it to somebody, I would make it a much more grounded drama pitch, as opposed to, like, this is Saul Goodman. You know, this is a battle of two brothers, one who is a con artist, the other who takes the law very seriously. And they have a deep history and they are constantly at odds. And, you know, if that kind of drama sounds interesting to you, then go for it. If it doesn't, I don't think that saying this is the journey of Jimmy to Saul Goodman is really going to change that, because he's right. I mean, in as much as this show is named Better Call Saul, it is kind of the exact opposite so far. We haven't seen a damn lick of Saul other than who Jimmy kind of is. And Saul is just an extension of his personality at some point. But if you're watching this without having watched Breaking Bad, what does Better Call Saul mean to you? It's a commercial that aired once in the pilot, I think.
Yeah.
Like, you see Gene watching a Better Call Saul video that obviously he made.
Right.
When he was a younger man.
And that's not to
say
that you can't enjoy Better Call Saul if you've not seen Breaking Bad, because obviously every time we say something like that, people write in and be like, yeah.
Sure, but if you...
I think you're going to have your fucking minds blown when you get around to Breaking Bad. But,
right.
The other thing is... It's just a different show. And I'll say that, like, as much as I like the Mike and Gus stuff, and as much as I gushed over the Gus stuff last week, mm-hmm. I think this is the best episode Better Call Saul's ever had. Because it was a slow burn, and it finally brought something that we've been wanting to see for a long time, which was Chuck and Jimmy just really go at it.
Mm-hmm.
And for Jimmy to beat his brother on his own turf. If you can't appreciate the drama of that and why that's kind of awesome in the exact same way that, like, Walt whipping up some explosive crystal and blowing out the windows of some, you know, underworld hideout is in season one, then I don't know what to tell you. That's a perfectly fine attitude to have. It's just, you know, you either get the slow burn and why the slow burn is it's fucking tedious and it's trying and it's something that you have to kind of train yourself to like super black coffee or espresso or like really hoppy beer. But once you get there and you see the payoff, it can be much more powerful than something that's just like an action-packed hour every single week.
Yeah.
But it's not for everybody.
Right.
It's like Cincinnati chili. It's not for fucking everybody. John K., I usually like to have the obvious setups pay off right away. So when they ended up the previous episode with Kim saying bingo and not filling us in on what the plan is, I was bummed but gave them the benefit of the doubt. All right, I'm gonna go ahead and drink this guy's milkshake. I feel like we discussed this already.
Yeah, I'm still not sure about the bingo.
And it could be, like, if we never see anything else, I'm going to assume the bingo is that Chuck thinks that everything's about to tape. So he's going to not be looking for the multiple sucker punches we got coming from it.
Right.
Hopefully we'll get a little bit more clarity, but if not, I'm going to go with that theory. Our buddy Barry G. While the courtroom scene had definitely a few elements of a few good men, it was also strongly influenced by the Kane mutiny, and he sent me the YouTube link that has the final 3 or 4 minutes of Humphrey Bogart losing his shit over a duplicate key for the strawberries that his men made and stole. And you substitute electromagnetic allergies for a man juggling steel ball bearings in his hand, and it's pretty much a shot-for-shot remake. Also, shout-out to my friend Laura Langston Zacek, who is a retired court reporter and has spent years working as background. This was her first SAG role as the court reporter in this episode.
Oh, okay.
Got a line from way back in the back.
Did. We can hear you, Chuck, I think was her tone.
I don't know what the court reporter shorthand for hashtag fuck Chuck is, but that's what she typed. Eliza V, quick observation about the Walter maybe poisoned Gene theory discussed last week. The initial criticism is that Jim saw Gene would be too deep undercover for Walter to track him down to poison. However, in season 5, episode 15, Saul and Walter are both camped out in the basement of the vacuum repair cleaner store.
Mm-hmm.
During this scene, Saul says to Walter, if I'm lucky, a month from now, best case scenario, I'm managing a Cinnabon in Omaha.
Yeah, but you take that guy seriously at that moment?
It's a lead. I mean, so let me throw this back to you. Yes, that does seem like just Saul's trademark bullshit, but it also comes true.
It does, but it's a Saulism. Like, if I'm like, Walter White doesn't take seriously most of the shit that Saul says.
Right.
Like, he suggests a nail salon. That's a serious suggestion, but Walt dismisses it completely.
If you wanted to track down Saul, would you dismiss that or would you at least check into it?
I don't even know if you remember it.
Mm.
Like, he's got so much other stuff to be concerned about. Getting his money to his kid.
Chemotherapy in a cabin in New Hampshire. Okay. The setup for the theory is there, but I don't like it for two reasons. One, it's a sloppy job by late Walter White standards. What if Jimmy decides to buy lunch? What if Saul survives and it backfires on Walt, interfering with his plans to wrap up his affairs? If he wanted Saul dead, it seems more likely Walt would sneak into Gene's apartment, wait for him to get home, and ensure the deed was done before leaving. Although that's not really late Walter White style either.
Yeah, he's a little more cavalier.
Yeah. How many times did Walt actually shoot a person dead? like Mike.
He
also killed those Nazi. Dudes he ran over. He killed those dudes he ran over. And, right. Well, yeah, he did shoot a lot of Nazis at that trunk job. Withdrawn.
Really, his car shot the Nazis. That'd be like Michael Knight taking the fall for Kit shooting up a bunch of people.
Late season 5, Walt is too damn good to not kill his target. If Gene collapsing at the Cinnabon is actually the character's death, why the hell have we followed him for one full sequence at the beginning of every season? Fair point. Fair point. On a totally different topic, I'm a little nonplussed by tonight's episode, Chicanery. Don't get me wrong, unlike many viewers, I'm enjoying the stately pace, and I haven't felt bored of this show for even 1 minute. But I don't see how Chuck's humiliation during the bar proceedings is going to help resolve Jimmy's current predicament. Even if Chuck's credibility is ruined in the context due to mental illness, I don't see that gets Jimmy out of trouble at the bar. There is too many other witnesses to Jimmy's crimes. I agree. And as you pointed out, this hearing is not over.
Yeah.
It is at a very pivotal point.
At least I don't think it's over. What if they come back next episode and they just assume everything's resolved?
The state bar did rest, so their part of the case is over, except for maybe their closing statements. So maybe, but it does.
I just don't think they sealed the deal.
It does feel awfully unresolved and unfinished, I think.
Yeah.
Michael and Costa Mesa. I thought it was interesting in how Chuck's practice testimony, he mentioned Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, in comparison to Jimmy. If one of McGill's brothers would carry out crimes against humanity as in a response to modern technology, I'd bet on the tong-wielding electrophobe over the TV commercial savant. I thought that was pretty funny, too, because famously the Unabomber's brother is one who turned him in because he recognized the handwriting and also knows his brother was a fucking weirdo. So he turned him in, and he's trying to draw a connection. And he's the Luddite.
Right.
Like, I thought that was a really smart reference to make. Sully from Boston. Great episode. Chuck references Perry Mason, but I also thought about The Godfather and A Few Good Men. In The Godfather parallel, Jimmy purposely creates a break when his ex-wife appears, giving the opportunity for Chuck to escape with his dignity intact. That's an interesting interpretation. Did you see that one Reddit thread that was trying to recontextualize this as an entirely benevolent take on Jimmy? They're like, oh, this wasn't a ploy to get Chuck emotional. This was Jimmy's genuine concern for his brother, and that since he wouldn't be able to take care of him anymore, he needed his ex-wife. That's drinking the old margarita aid right there.
Yeah, let me guess. They used the sort of satisfied look in the flashback that Jimmy gives as a supporting evidence. Like when Rebecca and Chuck are having kind of a moment.
Right.
You see a close-up of Jimmy in the kitchen going, I did a good thing here.
Right.
Look at them having fun together.
Yeah, no, they are saying that's the reason that intro was there is to serve as a bookend for the thing that he does later in the episode. He's literally still in all this trying to get them back together.
Talk about being in the tank for Jimmy.
Come on.
Yeah, it's too much.
Come on. I get it. Hashtag fuck Chuck. fuck Chuck. But come on. Come on. Then also, like Nicholson's Colonel Jessup, Chuck is baited into unmasking himself as Chuck confesses his form of code red vengeance on his brother and retribution for a lifetime of transgressions. Chuck aptly describes Jimmy as doing the worst things for reasons that almost seem noble, just as he does an even worse thing for reasons he can only rationalize as noble. I did like that analysis. We got a couple more before the legal corner. John H., did anyone else get a strong Walter White vibe when Chuck was delivering his lie to Rebecca about the reason for not having electricity? It smacked the same sort of desperation, a proud man willing to create a complicated fiction simply to hide his medical or psychological condition from the woman he loves.
I mean, if there's ever a story of digging yourself deeper with lies, it's Walter fucking White, right?
But same way, like, I always thought it was interesting how he would spin this elaborate, airtight lie. I mean, if you're going to lie to your wife, which I strongly encourage you not to do, fucking keep it simple, man. Don't add a lot of obviously verifiable details that can trip you up. Come on. I can see Chuck poisoning a kid or blowing up a nursing home, but do you think this is a sign that he could go even darker in his battle with Jimmy? Oh, I'm sorry. I can't see Chuck. I could, because hashtag fuck Chuck. But I like this. I like this. What do you think?
I think he's got a second cell phone. think Chuck actually has a cell phone.
He's had a cell phone his whole time, that son of a bitch.
Yes, it's hidden in the other drawer in his desk. It's a Hello Kitty cell phone.
It's hidden
That's
in
where
his,
Jimmy gets it.
It's hidden in his other breast pocket.
It is. He didn't know about it.
I think it'd be funny if he showed up in the court with like a Bluetooth earpiece in his ear.
Right.
Chuck?
Met this guy in the hall. Oh, if Ken Wins had been the guy that implanted or that planted the, like a headset on him.
Ken Wins, even in state disbarment court.
It takes a light touch to put an earpiece in your ear without knowing it.
Oh, really? A light, professional, discreet touch. I do think that that's one of the ways this can go. Chuck just going even like really getting into the mud. And I've been thinking ever since that emailer sent that in about, like, Jimmy pleading with his brother, get down in the mud with me, Chuck, and how that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
I could see him going even further into this and it ending very, very badly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Doug L. in the writer's corner says, I suspect you really enjoyed the schadenfreude of this episode, even though the writers are smart enough to ensure that even Chuck's comeuppance was still tinged with pathos. Oh, boy, did I. In any event, rather than parsing the little legal issues of individual pieces of the hearing, I thought it might be more useful to discuss the Perry Mason moment. The Perry Mason moment is an incredible thing to witness, and they do occasionally happen in trial, but they are not very common. The reason is that lawyers do not want to hitch their success at trial to hoping their opponent will react as planned when confronted with some surprise.
Yeah.
Trials are about trying to minimize risk through thoughtful preparation. We've all heard that chestnut that an attorney never asks a question he does not already know the answer to. Now imagine confronting a witness where you're counting on an unknown answer so good that the entire case falls apart. That's not to say witnesses do not come unglued on the stand or that surprises do not happen. I've seen both. But in my experience, that is something rarely that you can engineer. Some of the best advice I've received as an attorney was not to worry about hitting home runs. You're better off just hitting a string of singles. Then when it's time for the closing argument, you take all those little pieces of evidence you've collected and put them together in a way that perhaps the opposition did not see coming. It's death by a thousand cuts and not one sledgehammer. So what happens next? It seems clear Jimmy will not be disbarred entirely, though that could be still be sanctioned to some lesser extent, since if it was not proven that he knowingly destroyed evidence, he unquestionably broke into Chuck's house and destroyed something.
Mm-hmm.
As for Chuck, it's entirely possible this could trigger a competency hearing for him, perhaps paving the way for Howard to oust him from HHM. We'll have to see. We haven't talked about that. I do think they laid a lot of groundwork for that ouster at HHM.
Totally. I mean, Howard has already been dubious about the motives of Chuck. Across the board. I mean, we've seen it in his house when he's hired the private eye, like over the years with the, you know, this claim of nepotism.
We started this fucking show with Howard trying to force out Chuck.
Right. And it does feel like that's about to come back around.
Right. I agree. The core of the case was never to fucking tape, and they made that clear over and over and over again. So now, I guess the question is, it seems like even Chuck knew that even with him breaking in, that maybe, and we heard that from the lawyer last week, that it seems more likely that, you know, someone would get some sort of suspension or official disciplinary action and not a disbarment. It seems like that Chuck even knew that it was going to take the tape and him connecting the dots, and him carefully explaining the history to get a full disbarment.
Mm-hmm.
What seems likely is that Jimmy is going to, you know, get ousted. Or not get ousted,
suspended.
Get some kind of censure or something. Yeah. Okay, so that's the legal corner draws our feedback bag, our feed bag to a close.
The strings on the top of the feed bag.
It cinches it shut like a tiny little sphincter.
What kind of – are we using Velcro fasteners or do we have
– Oh, no. It's a string.
It's a string?
It's a string.
Okay.
But what's going to dribble out is the tiniest little spoiler section. It's mm-hmm. going to be essentially us talking about the next time on, which we don't normally do because who gives a shit. But this is a big one. If you haven't seen it, then you know it's now a big one, and you just need to stay away. If you have seen it and you want to hear us geek out about it a little bit, then follow us onto the spoiler section.
All right.
Also, apparently there's some kind of preview of Club Bald Move content coming up, too.
Yeah, I guess so.
So there's all that. But that's it. And we'll see you next week for another exciting episode of the Alpine Shepherd Boy, known as Jimmy McGill. We'll see you then. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Bye-bye. Okay, for the first time, Jim has seen the promo for next week, and I always watch him, but we don't usually talk about him. This one was a big one. Do you want to talk about why? I mean, it's a crazy preview in general, but there's a real hammer at the end.
Max Arciniega's going to get all his hair pulled out. That's apparently a thing that's happening.
If you don't know our pal, Max Arciniega, he's Crazy 8 from season 1, and he also had a little cameo from last season as well.
Yeah. No, the big thing is Kim at the end saying Saul Goodman.
Yeah. And title of the episode is Off Brand.
Uh-huh.
So the question is this going to be the long-awaited – and there's a lot of things going on here. Chuck is being squeezed by Howard. Jimmy's being squeezed by Chuck's ex-wife.
Rebecca, yeah.
Nacho's being squeezed by Hector. Mm-hmm. Crazy 8's being squeezed by Nacho.
Specifically, its scalp.
It's just a giant juicing operation.
It is,
and we're going to see the New Mexico University film crews being squeezed by Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like one of the things that we've speculated is that Chuck will agree to let this go if Jimmy stops practicing under the McGill brand.
Okay. Yep.
Explaining the title off brand and explaining the Saul Goodman.
Yeah.
But we know that, like, you know, obviously. Jimmy, by his own accounts, he says that he took this name, among other reasons, in the original chronology of Breaking Bad because it's a more Jewish-sounding name.
Uh-huh.
And the long-standing and probably racist connotations of, you know, Jews being lawyers and bankers and whatnot, mm-hmm. agents, etc. Is that what we're seeing? That this is going to be the end game, that Chuck's like, you know what? Fuck you. You can practice law, but you can't do it with my fucking name.
Yeah, but I don't see the leverage that Chuck has at this point. Like, it depends on how the case turns
out,
right?
Well, that's why, you know, like our buddy Doug L. says at the end, he's still guilty of this crime.
Right.
And
maybe he can pull some strings. Maybe he offers to, like, talk to the bar and see if they can,
like,
go easy on him.
The bar saying that, like, you know, maybe they'll suspend your license for a year. What are you going to do if you can't? Like, are you really going to saddle Kim with a year's worth of expenses that you can't help her at? You can't even, I'm assuming if you're suspended, you can't even, like, do paralegal shit.
I would imagine.
So, or I can make this all go away. You can do whatever the hell you want. You got to be Saul Goodman.
I could see that.
Yeah.
That's his leverage.
Now, what does that do to one's commercials that have established you as, you know, all-American hero Jimmy McGill? It also explains why they got the New Mexican University film students back out. Because
now
he's
new
doing
commercials.
And it's going to be... do you think it's going to be a sharp left at Albuquerque, to quote Bugs Bunny, that, like, it's going to go right from all-American, you can a name you can trust, to... Oh, I fucking wrecked my car drunk! Better call Saul! You know, is it going to be just, like, right to there? Or is he going to try to do the name you can trust shit to start with?
I mean, he's still got the elder law practice, right? I mean, he's still doing that thing. So I think it's going to be a little softer of a turn.
Does he? Kim's got his elder law practice.
Well, she's got some of it. I mean, he's still got elder clients.
Yeah.
And that's kind of his fallback here.
Yeah.
So maybe a soft turn. Although I'm kind of rooting for a hard turn.
He's got the elder clients. He's got Cthulhu. Shub Sugaroth,
the Elder Gods.
Oh, Elder God. Okay, I thought that's what we're talking about. It's like, what kind of law? It's like, what kind of unfathomable, cosmically horrific legal issues would they struggle with? Send feedback to bettercastsaul@baldmove.com. We just talked all this about, like, well, who knows when Saul will show up? But he might show up next week, in which case do I send out the bat signal to whoever it was that
tell him the show's back on.
Yeah, here's why you start watching Saul. Saul has reared his ugly head.
It seems like Dave,
start watching again.
Yeah,
start watching next week because Saul's back.
I'm excited.
All right, well, that's it for good now.
Okay.
Hardcastle and Stalker.
Even this is like your generic buddy crime.
Even the way, right? I said Hardcastle and Stalker, you can tell it's just a generic buddy.
Okay, we definitely need to pick the actors. I mean, so, that's the most important thing of any crime drama show, right?
So Hardcastle sounds like a real fire plug of a man. Like
he does.
He's just like who's Vic Mackey from The Wire?
Yeah.
Or not? Yeah, The Wire. Vic Mackey from The Wire, from The Shield.
What is that guy's name?
I don't know. He's like the thing with him is that he's like 5 foot nothing.
Yeah.
So like everyone sells him as just.
Then I got the perfect pair. What's the second guy's name? Hardcastle and what?
Stalker.
Stalker?
Yeah.
John Leguizamo.
Is the Stalker?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you're going.
He's a small guy too. So like.
Michael Chiklis. God, that's
Chiklis,
his name.
Yeah.
So you're going for like Stalker creepy. Not Stalker, like Hunter or
right, and like
Jungle
kind of
Cat.
Annoying and just yeah.
Okay, John.
He'd give Hardcastle a real.
You sure
hard
you don't
time.
Want to get his cousin here, Leguizamo?
Leguizamo, like
Leguizamo, like Leguizamo.
Nah, he's already got enough work. We're gonna bring John back in.
Who is the other guy that was like in a bunch of old late '80s movies that he's like Brian Dennehy? You know, the guy from like Cocoon?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Like, I think he's a good Hardcastle.
He would
pair
be a good
well. He'd pair well with a Leguizamo.
All right. I think what you really need is you need that odd couple feel, right?
Yeah.
You need, like,
Hardcastle's,
the straight man and the ridiculous bozo.
He's literally a hard ass. Like, he's just this uncompromising, angry dude guy.
And Stalker has one leg. Because we got to, we have to give him quirks. I mean, we can't just do a straight up.
He's
crime
John
drama.
Leguizamo. He comes out of the box like loaded.
I bet
with
you,
quirks.
John Leguizamo. John Leguizamo came up with the idea. Give me one leg. Just take away one of my legs. You know that's going to cost a lot, John. We're going to have to CG that.
Yeah.
I don't care.
What,
it's part of my character. I've built it.
Does
into
he
it.
Have a like one of those you know carbon fiber spoon legs? Or does
oh,
he have...
yeah, he's got like a first generation one that he can't really control all that well.
Okay, all
and,
right.
Or maybe it's the ones that like last for 3 months and then your nerve cells get coated in this
what
residue.
The fuck?
Have you heard of this?
No, huh?
Yeah. So apparently, like the prosthetics that they've been testing on people, like stop working after a while because
really?
Like your nerve endings, the receptors get
they
like
get,
coated
like,
in some kind of. Yeah, some kind of residue.
Wow.
And so they just stop working. So maybe that's the key. Like,
every 3 months he has to get a new leg? Or every 3 months he has to take 3 months off walking?
Right. Or he just has to drag the leg around because he's got emergencies that he's got to
He probably has
fix.
A wheelchair.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Does Hardcastle push him around in a wheelchair?
Sure, it's a crime buddy drama.
Uh-huh.
Where one of them is... half the time in a wheelchair, half the time a superhero. and the other one just resents him
the
whole time.
With a faulty superpower.
Right.
Right.
Half the time he has a bionic leg that he can leap buildings with.
Mm.
Half the time he can't get out of bed.
Okay. That's certainly a fish out of where the other location. Where they have to have, like, it's got to be Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's got to be Boulder, Colorado. It's got to be New York City. It's got to be... It's got to be Lubbock, Texas.
Lubbock.
Hardcastle seems like you'd be from Lubbock.
It sure does, yeah.
Lubbock, Texas. The heart of Lubbock.
I like it.
And they're hunting down drug dealers and mules and...
Cattle rustlers.
Cattle rustlers, sure. There's some cattle rustling going down there.
Yep.
And then you got the Texas Walker Ranger. Walker, Texas. The Texas Walker Ranger. That's going to be the epic crossover.
Oh, man.
Because that's like, turns out that Hardcastle and Walker went to the same, like, police academy.
Hardcastle and Stalker meets Walker.
Yeah. And they both hate Stalker. So, like, he's going to have to win him, and he's going to show up in one of the 3 month phases where he doesn't have his foot. So he's going to have to win him over. He's going to have to dig deep and impress Walker based on his non superhero configuration.
And he's unable to do it for 3 months. He's been trying and trying to impress Walker, get him to like him. And then finally his leg comes back online and he does the sweetest roundhouse kick.
Oh.
And Walker's like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh, man. I was going for more the heartwarming that he's going to just, like, do solid police work and prove that you don't need a superpowered leg. You can be a disabled American, but yeah, sure, get your super leg back and suddenly you're worth a damn. you won me over the sweet roundhouse kick, honestly. Okay.
Oh, man.